Hi, this is the Control Framework Working Group. It's 20 of 9, so we're going to pretend it's 8:30 and start. As with all good TV shows, we first have a word from our sponsor.
So, good morning. This is an announcement about an agenda change. So, this working group is going to end at 8:30 at 10 o'clock. It's going to run for 90 minutes, and then we're going to have a half an hour session on cross-cutting issues that have bubbled up from the other working groups that met in parallel yesterday. So these are issues that not only touch other working groups, but may touch project members who weren't able to attend the individual sessions. So it's a chance to get a little bit of plenary discussion on some things that otherwise you might not have seen. So I'll be running that session, and it'll happen immediately after this working group session is done. Thanks.
Okay. This is our agenda. I am John McCluskey, one of the current chairs. Larry Peterson is here. He will wave. He's in the back. We're going to introduce a few folks. We're going to talk very briefly about a document that's been worked on for quite some time called the Control Framework Requirements Spec. And then we're going to have a substantive and somewhat detailed discussion on a particular issue of network stitching, which is in part a report from a breakout meeting that was held in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and in part just sort of work that's been going on in the control frameworks. So let me move right to introductions. There are really two. We have new chairs as of the next meeting. As Aaron mentioned, it's been 2 years, which is kind of hard to believe, but it's true nonetheless. One of them is a really interesting kind of round guy named TBD. We haven't actually found him yet, but we're working on it. The second one is Rob Ritchie, who is standing here in front. He actually has to stand up. He can't just wave. So probably most of you know him. He's the PI of the Protogenie Control Framework Project. He's at the University of Utah. He's hosting the next one of these. And for the next 2 years, he's going to get to do this. And so that's really cool. The second person that I would like to introduce is Christopher Small from BBN. As you guys know, all of these working groups have a systems engineering person from the Genie Program Office, Project Office, I always get that wrong, whose job is to work with the working group to help the work move ahead and to make sure that it is professionally documented and described and captured and done in a, that meets the sort of the requirements of an engineered project. And Chris is actually new to the whole Genie project. I think he's going to be up here at some point, he may want to say a little bit about that. But he's been doing systems research for quite a while at several different well-known places. Several people, when I mentioned this to them privately, said, oh, I know Christopher. That's great. I've done a number of startups as a software developer, and he's got several roles in the Genie thing. He's, as I said, now the new systems engineer for this group. And he's also the systems engineer for three of the Spiral One projects. The next topic, there is a document. I'm going to say a little bit about this. I think Chris wants to say a little bit about this. This is a document that's been worked on in this group for some time, and it started as an attempt to capture the requirements of a control framework, and it's grown over time. It's become, I think, rather a large document. It started to capture, to get a lot of implementation information as well, and has been on a path that started really long before the control frameworks themselves got going. And it's been stuck a little bit. And so what we've decided to do is reset this process a little, particularly now that the control frameworks have advanced and we have both more concrete stuff to work from and a little more experience. And we also have a new systems engineer to help us work on. Is Harry here? Is Harry Mussman here? Harry is our old system engineer. And I would like everybody to thank him and stand up and just really support him. Harry has worked his butt off to get this document in place against a really interesting process of people with different views. And, you know, we're doing a reset because we know more now But I want to recognize his contribution because it has been huge, and he has also done it with tremendous good spirit, and I am very grateful. Okay, Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about your views on this? Or do you want me to just run through this? We have one slide. I'll do it. Yeah. So lots of revisions of this has been posted. We have 5 control frameworks. We're going to just take a step back. We are, however, going to try a novel concept, which is to do it with a schedule. So our intended plan, and I want to say that this is a proposed plan, it's subject to input from the CFWG PIs and anybody else that would like to provide input. But our desire first is to sort of get a grip on the scope that we actually want it to cover. I think terms and glossary is pretty straightforward. I think that we're actually in good shape on that. But there are some places where the different control frameworks have evolved different use of the same words, which is always exciting. Then the heart of this document is understanding what are the minimal requirements that are imposed on one of these control frameworks, not the maximum set of requirements, the minimum set of requirements. And this has to do a lot with the transition of this process from its origins as a very large single engineering project into a space that's much more exploratory, that's much more federated, that's much more community developed. And it really reflects the maturing of Genie as a project. So we're going to review these requirements. We're going to revise the document once and try to have a checkpoint version by the next one of these meetings, which Rob is running in his hometown. And then we're going to take another step and look at the notion of what interoperability between control frameworks might look like, what the functional interfaces ought to be. And again, it's not implementation, it's requirements, right? So this is requirements on interfaces. And we're going to do another checkpoint. So our plan is going to be to do this following, as you may have noticed, Genie in many ways is following the model of the IETF of 10 years ago. It has working groups. It has small groups that are off doing things. It has many projects. It brings them together to try and form consensus around the key common parts. I am absolutely certain that that's because Aaron Falk has been sort of a master of the IETF for the last 10 years, and he's just moving the process over. So I think as part of moving that process over, we will convene what we might call a design team for this document. That would be one or two people from each of the control frameworks and a small group of others to try and make quick progress and then bring it to the working group as a whole for review and comment and revision. And we'll be trying to put that process together starting really next week as soon as this meeting is over. That is the end of that topic, unless anyone would like to make a comment or ask a question. Okay. Or boot your Macintosh. The next topic is network stitching. Network stitching is an interesting word that has popped up. And it has to do with the fact that if you have 17 different aggregates and they all implement some form of network, you need to patch them together if you want end-to-end results. There was a meeting on this topic, and I'm going to ask Chris to report a little bit on the meeting and lay out the groundwork, and then we have 4 talks from 4 different projects that have a contribution in this space.
So the goal of the GPO is to support research in non-IP networking. And in order to do that, we need to provide some non-IP or some experimental test, pieces of experimental test bed that can run non-IP. So what we need to do in order to figure this out is to decide what a control framework needs to do to support stitching together a slice for non-IP experimentation. We have 3 different groups that have looked at this problem and been working on implementations of this kind of stitching. And so we're going to get a summary from these three projects of what they looked at, how they approached the problem, the way they solved it, what pitfalls there are there, and a proposal or a plan for doing this in a fourth system. And then we're going to, as a group, this offer this as food for thought to the group to see what we can learn from the prototypes that have been built, what we can abstract away from them, and what should be in a, what we think should be in a control framework in order to support network stitching. So that's the end of this. The first talk is from, I lost my agenda. Chris Tracy will be going first, then Rob Ritchie, Yufeng Xin, and then Larry Peterson. So Chris, are you here? Here he comes. All right, this is working out.
Okay, everybody hear me okay? Very good. Hello, my name's Chris Tracy. I'm from the Mid-Atlantic Crossroads. We're part of the Cluster B, and our project is Manfred, also known as Dragon. So I'm going to be talking about network stitching. Just a quick outline here of the talk is I'm going to start out with some of the typical goals of why you want to do network stitching. Some thoughts on our view of deterministic services. What are the challenges of stitching different types of networks together? And then I'm going to explore a little bit about the end-to-end slices across network aggregates. And so how are we going to tie together different network aggregates across Genie, and some of our thoughts on that issue. So typically, the goals of network stitching have typically been to establish some kind of dedicated paths across multiple domains. Usually these are services that are deterministic in nature. They have some sort of guaranteed latency, jitter, performance, certain amount of bandwidth is guaranteed. But I think in terms of Genie, one of the more important aspects of stitching these networks together is we want to provide the ability to transmit non-IP traffic to allow for experimentation of with new protocols that are not IP based. So this may mean stitching together layer two networks, for example, so that you can experiment with new layer two protocols, alternatives to IP, for example. And just as an example, some of the experiments that we've been involved with have been HDTV transmission directly over raw wavelengths, for example, or InfiniBand or fiber channel over Ethernet or Sonnet circuits, for example. So these are just a couple examples in our own network that we've come across that there have been various advantages to doing this instead of using IP. Okay, so just a couple thoughts on deterministic services in our view. I feel that this is an important consideration for experiment repeatability. As a researcher, I would hope that when I access Genie, I'm able to run my experiment in a repeatable fashion so that I can, you know, I can perform the same experiment over and over, making slight modifications, and I can actually get the same kind of resources. I don't have to worry about things changing from run to run. Otherwise, I don't know how I would, you know, be able to compare my results. So I think that the quality of service not only needs to be at the network level, but also at the CPU level. This is a problem we've seen, for example, on the Amazon Elastic Cloud service, where you might run an experiment and you're in one part of the cloud, and then you run your experiment again and you're in a different part of the cloud. So it's a difficulty in kind of making sure you get the same resources from one experiment to another. And so the things like network congestion shouldn't be impacting these experiments, and some experiments and applications may just be more sensitive to network performance variations, and they just require these kind of deterministic services. In particular, these are the kinds of applications we've typically worked with on our network prior to working on Genie. So these were mostly real time or interactive remote steering types of applications, for example. So moving on to the challenges of network stitching, I think the biggest problem is that you have a multi-technology environment. There's a lot of different network technologies that are sitting out there. You have multiple different flavors of Ethernet, everything from untagged to single tag to multiple VLAN tags to complete recursion, MAC and MAC Ethernet, for example, provider backbone bridges. You have differences within SONET, SDH. You know, some equipment will want to do contiguous concatenation. Some can support virtual concatenation. If you're stitching together all optical networks, you have issues with wavelength spacing and alignments. So there are a number of different issues here. If you're trying to connect, if you're using MPLS, for example, some networks are based on IP routers, and you can set up layer 2 VLANs, like a virtual leased line. Other options, there may be just IP MPLS networks that just use QoS or premium IP that you're just marking packets with a differentiated service code point, for example. So tying together these kinds of networks where you have different domains using all these different types of network technologies underneath can be quite challenging when you want to establish a path across multiple domains. And just establishing the path is hard enough, and how does this affect the performance over such a link that is stitched together with these different hybrid of different technologies. You also have some networks that support automatic provisioning. Some of the groups within Genie have systems that can support automatic provisioning. Others still require manual configuration at the equipment level in many cases. So. Okay, so just moving on a bit, I'm going to talk just a bit about how we might think about modeling some of these networks. There's been a lot of really good work going on inside the OGF. In a couple of the working groups, the Network Measurement Working Group and the Network Markup Language Working Group have both come up with schemas to describe networks. So some of you may already be familiar with this. I know some of them, some of these are even being used within projects already, such as the ORCA project. So I'm just going to briefly go over the scheme that we use currently in our own project. And it's quite basic. It starts off with looking at a single domain, how do you represent a single domain? So there's a URN that specifies this domain uniquely. And moving on to a node, you have three nodes here that have switching capabilities. So you refer to each of these as a domain, a particular domain, a particular node. And then you can look at the port level, where you're looking at only one particular node and which ports you're talking about on each of those. And finally, you might you get even further down into actually looking at the link level. So basically, we have domains, nodes, ports, and links. And once you get to the link level, this is where a lot of the specific information about the technology really is captured. So in this particular example, we're showing the endpoints of a link, And you'll see in the next slide how we describe a little bit more detail about these the switching capabilities of this link. In this case, it's an Ethernet. It's 802.1Q, so it's capable of actually carrying tagged VLAN traffic, or untagged, which I didn't put on the slide here. But so you'll see in the next slide, here's an XML representation of this whole ontology, starting from domain here at the top. You see the domain, the node. There's various ports here. I've kind of closed up a couple of those, so the details of those are hidden. But one is actually expanded, so you can actually see the details of this particular port. And so in this example, the way we model an interdomain link, for example, if it goes to another domain, the remote link ID simply specifies a domain that is outside of blue, for example. So you can deduce from this that this is an interdomain link that goes to some other domain. So this is where it gets interesting, where a lot of the switching capability information about the specific technology that's used is captured. So in this case, this is representing a layer 2 switch-capable Ethernet link that has a particular interface MTU of 9,000 bytes and a particular range of VLAN tags. So when we use this model to describe a Sonnet TDM circuit, for example, instead of having Ethernet there, it'll say it's a TDM switching capability, and down here you'll have a list of time slots instead of VLANs, for example, and you can also capture additional information about, you know, whether this is contiguous concatenation or virtual concatenation, what type of if link capacity adjustment scheme is supported. So you can think of this being extended to support wavelength switching, even packet switching if you're using MPLS. So the current schema actually captures how to represent these at a number of different layers. I'm not going to go into the details. There's some references at the end if you want to do further reading about this. Okay, so just a quick overview of how we are currently using this. So you can see here that there's a number of different networks that are connected together, and they're stitched together using Ethernet VLANs. We found that Ethernet VLANs is typically a easy way to stitch networks together, because most network technologies can terminate a VLAN somehow, whether it's an IP MPLS router, whether you're just running a native Ethernet switch, or even a lot of Sonnet switches can do Ethernet into Sonnet encapsulation. So in this, I'm just basically getting across here that these networks can be running different technologies underneath. I think you'll see in the next couple of slides how this works, where this network might be running one technology, this network might be running native Ethernet, this one might be running Sonnet, for example. Okay, and I'm just going to go ahead and skip over to this slide. So as I was just mentioning, here's a better example where you can see underneath this network is native Ethernet, this network is Sonnet in the core, and this one is a layer 3 router in the core. All of these are essentially terminating Ethernet VLANs. So in the case of the routed domain, these are MPLS LSPs that are being provisioned across the routers, and they're being stitched to a VLAN using something like the Martini draft, or Juniper has something called a circuit cross connect that you can use to stitch a VLAN into an MPLS LSP. Across the middle, this is a Sonnet switch domain that has Ethernet ports on the edge. So it's using a GFP, frame GFP encapsulation to basically tunnel Ethernet frames into a Sonnet VCG. So these are just a couple examples of real-world examples of how we're actually stitching together networks right now. And in this particular example, this network that's native Ethernet could represent the Dragon network. This Sonnet switch network could represent the Internet 2 dynamic circuit network, and the routed domain as the ES network. This is actually all infrastructure that's actually already in place, and it's actually running right now and is actually hooked up this way, and we can provision across it. So just a couple more slides just to wrap up here. Another way to model networks is something called the network description language, or the network markup language. Their approach is somewhat similar, but those of you who are interested in how to model networks might find this work this work interesting. When we think about network models, you typically think of a graph, just a very simple graph, something like this. But it's not, you know, this view is not quite very, it's not very accurate. So if you zoom in here a bit and look at the vertices and the edges, the incident on of an edge on a vertex is an interface. So you'll see on the next slide here, we have interfaces here. You could think of this as a device. These as being interfaces out here on the edge, and these are links emanating out from it. So all of these interfaces have various properties, even when they're disconnected. So you can already think of having these kind of map directly to the terminology that we use within our own project. So instead of nodes, they're using devices, for example, in their description language. Instead of ports, they're using interfaces, and we both agree on the terminology of links, for example. But just going a little bit further in, you can think of inside of this device, there's some kind of switching matrix, and there's typically some kind of multiplexing or demultiplexing that's happening from these interfaces. So, for example, in the case of an Ethernet switch, you can think of different VLANs as being these different channels, or in a case of a SONET circuit, these will be different time slots. In the case of a wavelength switch, it would be different wavelengths. So this model can apply to pretty generally across all different kinds of network technologies. If it's a IP router, they could be MPLS LSPs, for example. Okay, so that's about that's all I had. I think I have tried to stay within my time slot here. There's a couple of good references here for anyone who is interested in more information about network stitching. There's a deliverable from the GIANT2 network, testing of technology stitching. That was it's a very useful reference. There's more information about the last few slides that I just presented on the network description language. There's a quite extensive, much more elaborate description than what I just gave in that second link. And there's also some interesting work in the hybrid multi-layer network control, the data plane test report. So if this actually contains quite a lot of testing of different types of networks that were stitched together and what exactly the impact was on performance. So whenever they would stitch together layer two networks with IP routed paths and do, you know, extensive testing and measuring jitter and latency and bandwidth and how those were affected across all different kinds of paths. There's some very interesting results there. So, okay, and these slides will be posted online very shortly here, and they'll be on the Gini webpage as well as this webpage. So, thank you. Any questions or comments? Feel free; they're certainly welcome.
Talks for which you need to clap, but a working group for which you need to ask questions.
Yeah.
I know who you are.
All right, so similar to Chris, I'm going to talk about kind of the challenges of coordinating across aggregates to make connections happen. I'm going to talk more at the kind of control plane level and less at the sort of the specific interconnection technology level. So, so if we're going to stitch together so many of these projects that we're making, we need to actually be able to make, you know, links between them. And in simple cases, these are simple links, and we have two parties that have to communicate. And in more complicated cases, this may be an n-party communication problem. So right now in cluster C, so I'm going to talk about the kind of the are thinking so far in how to design some of these pieces for Cluster C. We have working support for VLANs within an aggregate and tunnels between aggregates. And sort of our motivating challenge that we're going to have in the next couple months here is making VLANs between aggregates. So constructing some tunnels between aggregates is relatively easy. So the one that we currently support in our control framework is GRE tunnels. The nice thing about these is these are stateless, which basically means that you just have to tell each endpoint of the tunnel that it is making the tunnel and what the address of the other end is, and there's sort of no coordinated setup between them. Just when both ends have configured their tunnel, then it just suddenly starts working. Of course, a lot of stitching is going to be harder than this because there's either some kind of stateful setup, right, where one end of the tunnel acts in some kind of server capacity and is connected to by the other end. Some kind of handshake has to occur. Maybe they have to communicate and establish encryption keys. In some cases, so Chris talked about stitching together VLANs, and this is also one of the things that we are working on. You have a limited identifier space, so you have to get both ends to agree on what identifier they're going to use. And more than just being a agreement between two endpoints of a link, this may be you actually run into some transitive problems here. So to pick the specific case of VLAN identifiers, if I have a VLAN that is crossing many different aggregates, modulo some support that some switches have, in general, I basically have to pick an identifier, the same identifier across every one of those aggregates, which makes life much, much harder. So in the slides that I'm about to present, I'm going to the key assumption that I'm going to make is that if I'm connecting together two aggregates, the thing that crosses that aggregate is a link of some sort. I'm not going to make many assumptions about what that link is. But that a component doesn't. That it doesn't make sense to talk about a specific component, a node that is controlled by multiple aggregates. So basically, it's readable. I have nodes in two aggregates, right? This link is going to be set up between them by configuring interfaces on the nodes in those aggregates. So we've talked in our working group about a couple of different alternative strategies to use to have these. To have these two aggregates communicate with the goal of setting up this link. And like I said, so this may be a wired link. It may be a VLAN tagged link. It may be a wireless link where the things that I have to agree on are frequencies or SSIDs or time slices or whatever. So I'm going to use the word link a lot here a lot, but understand that I mean that very generally. So the first alternative that we have talked about, and it's the one that we are currently using for tunnels, is basically that it is the client's job to run around talking to all of the aggregates. So basically the client who wants this link between two aggregates set up talks to aggregate A, finds out some things such as the tunnel endpoint that aggregate A is going to use on its end for the tunnel, and then the client goes and talks to aggregate B, and similarly get some stuff back from aggregate B about what its endpoint is, and then basically all information about setting up this tunnel passes through the client. The mechanism for this communication is simply the aggregate manager API calls that have already been described in the SFA document. The RSpec is the data structure that these things get transferred in. And this is nice because it doesn't require us to change really that aggregate manager API. But there are some obvious bad things here, which is that the client has to know a lot about what coordination is required to set up this link. So the client has to know that it has to contact both endpoints in a certain order or give them certain data. And for more than two endpoints, this gets really nasty. And it also means we have this kind of crappy data path, which is that the aggregates communicate with each other through the client. So alternative B that we've come up with is the client talks to both aggregates, and then those aggregates use some other channel to work out between them, right, to communicate tunnel endpoint information or to pick VLAN numbers or whatever. So the nice part about this is the client no longer has to know who needs to know what information when about to set up this this cross-aggregate link. And the bad thing is that it's really hard to get a kind of a global view here. So in this picture that I have for two aggregates, this is not too bad, right? The two aggregates can just talk directly to each other and to work something out. If I have 20 aggregates, what does that communication pattern look like? Is it all to all? Do they have to, you know, self-organize? It gets really messy, right? This requires a new control plane API that currently doesn't exist. I mentioned that we use RSpec as part of solution A, and RSpec is probably the medium in solution B here too. All right, our third solution is to use an intermediary where the client basically talks to that intermediary, and then the intermediary does the job of talking to both aggregate managers to coordinate things. So in that picture, the intermediary is untrusted. So this means that the intermediary is not has no special relationship with either of the aggregates that it's creating or that it's coordinating between, and it's simply acting on the client's behalf. Probably, you know, the client delegates rights to modify the slice to that intermediary. And that intermediary could be the term that has been used in Genie to describe something like this already is an aggregate of aggregates. So essentially what that would likely look like is that intermediary exports an aggregate interface and then behind the scenes goes out and talks to some other aggregate managers. So the nice thing about this is because there is no special trust required with the intermediary, every time it's very easy to set these intermediary aggregate of aggregates up, right? There's not a process of establishing trust with all the component with all the aggregate managers or any of this kind of stuff. And the bad problem is you may have noticed this basically just looked like my first option. I just sort of shifted the problem from the client onto somebody else, right? And that somebody else is probably a better place to put it, but fundamentally I still have all the problems of that intermediary has to know, if it's a tunnel, I only talk to two endpoints. If it's a VLAN, it's VLAN numbers I'm negotiating. If it's a wireless link, I have to negotiate channel numbers, right? Our final alternative that we've identified is, you may notice this looks exactly like my last alternative. And the difference here is that the intermediary now is trusted. So basically at some point, someone has, that intermediary has established some trust with the aggregates that it's that it's going to be able to coordinate between. You again, maybe could call this an aggregate of aggregates. That's slightly different than it's been used in Genie before. So the nice part about this is because you have some pre-established trust with this intermediary, it can have some kind of global authoritative view. So it's pretty easy, for example, to take the very specific case of say wireless spectrum, this trusted intermediary could be sort of the thing that has the global view of what spectrum is available and what spectrum each individual link is currently using. And sort of the bad part about this is that it scales poorly in that if I want to stitch something across all of Genie, I have to have an aggregate of aggregates that covers all of Genie. And this is the kind of thing where it has to be set up in advance, so I can only stitch across components and aggregates that already have some kind of pre-existing relationship. Okay, so this is just a list of those four, because I'm sure I'm going to forget which one was which and have to come back to the slide if we have a discussion. So our plan that we're going forward with in our control framework is to do a hybrid of B, which was direct coordination between the aggregate managers, and D, which was that trusted intermediary. We haven't defined this call yet, but we are going to define a new aggregate manager call, and the idea is that it is only usable by other aggregate managers. That's going to be used to coordinate link setup across aggregates. And the idea is that for two-party arrangements like tunnels, those aggregate managers will then simply contact each other using this call. The idea of this call is that it will be fairly generic in the sense that it will not be specific to any particular kind of link technology, and it will basically have an extensible argument that is basically only meaningful to two aggregates that speak the same link technology, right? So two aggregates that speak WiMAX, or two aggregates that speak VLAN, or two aggregates that speak tunnel. And the nice part, of course, is that you only have to worry about supporting the extensions for links types that you actually have, right? And if somebody tries to contact you with any other kind, then that's just an error. So this is a pretty simple extensibility story. So for two-party arrangements in our system, the aggregate managers are going to simply talk directly to each other to make these arrangements. The trusted intermediary, we're going to have a trusted intermediary, and the idea is that it is that when we have sort of multi-party kind of setup, that this will be done with a trusted intermediary. So I'll show you a little bit what that means in a sec. So the nice part about this is that the client no longer has to understand, what coordination is required to stitch together two aggregates. It simply talks to those aggregates, asks for a link to be set up, right? And then whether the aggregates communicate to each other or talk to the intermediary, this is all sort of hidden from the client. The client doesn't have to worry about this. The aggregate managers only have to worry about the link technologies they support, and the client doesn't have to understand that different link technologies require different kinds of coordination. The likely case for this trusted intermediary, we are going to be running a backbone on Internet 2 that's going to be used by our cluster and by some of the folks in cluster B. And the nice part about this is that basically, for the case of assigning VLAN numbers, there is a in this backbone arrangement, there is a backbone that everybody goes through. So it makes a lot of sense for that backbone to be a trusted intermediary and to have a pre-established trust relationship with everybody that it is who has a direct layer 2 connection to it. And then the idea is that that backbone will go ahead and hand out VLAN numbers, some range of VLAN numbers that for use in stitching across all backbones. And of course, there are some disadvantages to this. When you make an RSpec that you give to a component manager and to ask it for a link that includes another aggregate, you do have to include the other endpoint or many other endpoints if it's a multi-party kind of communication setup. You have to include that in the request that you give each RSpec, which is adds a little bit of adds a little bit more complexity to the RSpec. It's still the case that the client has to contact all of the endpoints of the link that they're trying to establish. So if, for example, if I'm trying to set up a tunnel and I talk to one guy, one end first, and that end turns around and tries to talk to the other end's going to say, I don't know what you're talking about yet, right? Because the client hasn't contacted it yet. So the client still does have to contact all the endpoints, and in general, the setup of the link is going to have to wait until all of the endpoints have been contacted. But that's our plan for how we're going forward on Spiral 2, and I would love to take questions or comments on this on these alternatives and our plan specifically. Yeah, Aaron.
Hello? Okay, there we go. So it seems like this adds several steps to the establishment of a slice that's got that requires network stitching, right? So it seems like there's phasing where things are sort of partially established. Like the example of sort of that the half established tunnel is part of that, and so I'm wondering if is there and this came up a little bit in the cluster meeting that there's different kinds of technologies have sort of different phases that they go through in the process of acquiring and establishing a slice, between completely unreserved and fully functional and integrated. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, is there some, is there the abstraction that we've talked about in the past was one that was, I think, sort of driven from the Planet Lab model of getting a virtual machine and then loading an operating machine system on it. Mm-hmm. But it seems like we need to sort of revisit that, and I'm wondering, do you have any insight on what the implications are here?
So what I would like to do. By having the client not participate in the coordination process, right? I would definitely like to hide that. I would like to hide all of these steps from the client, right? So essentially, the client will say, "Make me a sliver that happens to include this link that goes to another aggregate," right? And just as you don't tell the client that the sliver is made until. Within an aggregate, you don't tell the client the sliver is made until you've made it, right? Similarly, you don't come back and tell the client that you've made the sliver that includes a cross-aggregate link until that cross-aggregate link has successfully been established. And you could certainly view the idea of the resource has been so. I would say for components that are nodes, we've been talking about the idea that. There is the state where the resource is reserved to you, which is that you have a ticket. There is a state in which it is somehow provisioned but not running, right? Not booted, which for a node generally means not booted, right, or not executing. And then there's sort of this fully running state. And I think that looking at a link as a type of component here, you have this same idea of I've promised you this bandwidth and this and this VLAN tag or whatever. And then there's the I've talked to the other end and we have things set up, and then there's you can actually send packets through it. So I actually think that there isn't I think that the way you describe each of those states is different than it is for a node, but I think that the exact same states exist.
Do you think that there can be so this third party who's setting this up mm-hmm. on behalf of the user? Do you think that there can be multiple of these, and do all mm-hmm. of them need to be trusted by everything, all network aggregates?
Right. So, there certainly can be many, right? And I want at least our plan is that it is the aggregates that know about them, not the client, right? So. So essentially, basically, if you are going to take your if you're going to take your equipment and cross connect it with some other project's equipment, right? Then at that point, you are probably going to set up one of these trusted intermediaries, which may be one of the two endpoints, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't have to be a third party. To handle that, and I, looking at the set of projects that are in Genie, it looks like the sort of common case is that the two common cases are you either have some kind of direct physical connection. Between a pair, right, and then there might be pairwise connections out of there, or you have kind of an any to any, and the any to any ones are, tunnels or something like it that are much easier to set up without any kind of special collaboration, and the ones that have direct connections to each other, direct physical connections to each other, have to set up some kind of have to have some kind of pre-existing relationship anyway. Yeah. So I think that's why we kind of chose this particular hybrid of those two styles.
Okay. And one more comment, and then I'll shut up. And this is really sort of a concern, and I guess I don't expect you to have an answer to this now. But when this third party fails, when the process fails. Somebody needs to have enough information to figure out what happened to understand how to try again or who to talk to.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there is a bit more. The error as we design that additional API and design how the a little bit more detailed stuff works. You're right. The error we have to be very careful with how the error messages flow to make sure that you don't lose error messages.
Right, and you did say earlier that this was all going to be hidden from the user, and so that's what prompted that concern.
Yeah, so. That's a valid concern. Hold on,
Okay. Well, that discussion actually just sort of half addressed my question.
Oh, good.
But when I saw your presentation and you brought in this trusted intermediary, the first reaction that I had is it looks an awful lot to me like an aggregate manager for that network that's between the two nodes. And if you think about it as more or less in that way, I think you can get some leverage out of that image and simplify how much there is to think about it. And it was reinforced when you talked about having the trusted intermediary belongs to Internet 2, which is providing you with your long or the backbone provider that's providing you with the links.
And the reason, though, that I'd like to do that trusted intermediary kind of behind the scenes where the client doesn't see it, right, is that you know, if I have connections to multiple other parties, right, establishing a complex topology that involves many of them might involve me talking to multiple aggregates, whereas I think in the original formulation of the idea of an aggregate of aggregates that was sort of user visible, essentially, if I wanted to make some kind of topology that spanned, you know, a bunch of different aggregates in Genie, there has to be one aggregate manager that knows how to talk to them all. So.
Yeah, I agree that there's not a direct map existing, but maybe there's some leverage you can get out of making it more like the existing things.
Yeah, sure. All right, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Our third speaker is Yusheng Chen, who is heading up. Shall we say Ben more than Orca?
Ben and Orca. My name is Yu Feng. I'm from RENSI and working in for the. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm Yu Feng. I'm from RENSI, working for the Ben and Alka project. I'm speaking on behalf of both Ben team at RENSI and Alka team at Duke. And this is a joint Genie effort between these two teams. Okay. As Chris and Rob described all the different scenarios, so we have to be able to stitch pieces together in order to have an end-to-end slice. So before we jump into the details, and both technological and strategic detail, we want to see if we can formulate the problem in a little bit more formal way. So here is our take. Okay. So we are given a set of domains that physically are connected. And each domain, they have an available label set, whatever label it is. Okay. And right now, let's just assume VLAN stitching between domains. Okay. So we have the same stitching vehicle. And there are some key constraints in this picture. One is between different domains,
you know, the labels has to be compatible with each other. Okay, so if you have VLAN available at every domain, that's okay. But you know there are different VLANs. Okay, so the second one is if the label translation is allowed in one, some, or all the domains, that would change the problem space. And actually, the solution is a very classical one. And given these constraints, and given the network topology and the capacity, we are looking for a solution that first, you know, you are looking for available routing end-to-end. Second, you are looking for a label assignment. Third, you are looking for a configuration sequence, optimal configuration sequence that can actually stitch this together with assigned labels. So that's our take about this problem. And there are some different solution options according to the constraint and available technologies. First one, if we assume there's no label translation allowed in any domain. So right now we are looking for a routing and a label assignment that assumes a label continuity. So this is a known like hard problem, right? And even you can come up with a solution because of this label continuity constraint, the blocking probability is very high always. Okay, you can run simulation to show that. And anyway, if you assume no label translation, you can find an end-to-end a routing and a label assignment either via a centralized way or via a distributed way, like GMPS, MPS can not MPS, GMPS does. And secondly, if label translation is allowed in some of the domains, now label assignment becomes a local decision problem. And in this case, the problem is not that hard, and the blocking probability can be improved a lot. And in this case, another constraint or another thing, which is a neighbor relationship, becomes a very important thing. And I'll show why this is very important. So because of this neighbor relationship, the stitching problem, you know, becomes a kind of a little bit newer than the classic problem. So given the networking or given the environment we faced, we can define following neighboring relationship. By neighbor, I mean like different aggregate or different domains. One is a peer relationship. For example, in our network, the band network, we have a band network and we have a Duke campus. They don't have dependency between each other. They can assign labels, you know, totally free individually. Two, we are asked to interconnect our network via ANR or internet. In that case, we have a kind of provider and customer relationship because from ANR, they only give us a VLAN pool. Okay, they don't allow us to control their network. We cannot, you know, ask them to do VLAN translation or ask them to give us a specific VLAN. So in this case, you know, we have to accept the VLAN that ANR gives to us. And third relationship is called a master slave relationship. In this case, for example, we have different blade servers that are connected via BAN. And all these blade servers will be initiated with different virtual machines. After the virtual machines are initiated, okay, they will bring up a virtual Ethernet switch inside DOM 0, right? So in that case, the DOM 0 can be assigned a VLAN, but the VLAN has to be given from the switch at the BAN. In this case, you know, it's the VM side has to take the VLAN the same VLAN that is given from BAN. Okay, so given this relationship, the stitching problem becomes a sequencing problem, which means we have to find a dependency tree between the different domains, among the different domains or among the different aggregates. After that, okay, this problem turns to be a co-scheduling and can be classified as the known co-scheduling and a co-allocation problem. Okay, you can solve it centralizedly and just a one step shot. You'll find first the label assignment to the necessary label translation where. Okay, and secondly, we can solve the problem using a distributed or like kind of like a semi-distributed way. So you have different options here. One is you can set up a shared space, okay, somewhere, like a Java space. Okay, every domain, you know, send the label assignment to this shared space, and others will kind of pull the information and to decide its own VLAN assignment or its own VLAN translation. Two, we can do it in two steps. One, everybody assign VLAN a label and broadcast the label around to its customers or to its slaves. Okay, then the customer and the slave do the translation in the second step. Third option is you can do it sequentially, you know, from the provider to the master, then to the slave. And so currently we are using the last solution to finish the stitching, and I'll show how we do it. Okay, this is a real scenario that we demonstrated on Monday. So in order to create a slice from the Duke VM's cluster to RNC VM cluster and UNC VM cluster, we have to go through Ben, go through NR, go through the Duke campus network. So, and here we have a VLAN translation capability at the 6509 at Ben, and we have the translation capability at 6509 at between the DukeNet and the Duke VM side. So, according to the problem formulation we just looked at, okay, we can have a stitching sequence tree like this, according to the dependencies. We have to find to have a VLAN coming from NR first. And with a VLAN, we can pass it to Ben and Duke in parallel, and the Duke and Ben will assign a label, local label individually, and do the VLAN translation between its local label and the NR label. And thirdly, the Ben and the Duke Knight would pass their VLAN to their slaves, which are the three VM sides. The VM side then can initiate the VMs with VLAN assigned to the virtual Ethernet switch inside the server. Okay, so in order to achieve this, we kind of make use of the existing redeem predecessor capability in Alka. So we define this tree in Alka service manager, and pass a VLAN tags as a configuration properties among different aggregates when you redeem the tickets to different aggregates. So here is a view from Alka's perspective. So the up layer is the substrate that you need to stitch together, and the components at the bottom is on the right is a broker, right? Every set of authority delegated their VLAN resources and VM resources to the broker, and the slice controller will redeem the tickets to the set of authority or aggregate manager according to the sequence tree that I just showed you. So, and so what I just described is kind of like a horizontal stitching, right? You need to stitch different domains together. But actually, there's another dimension with the vertical stitching. For example, in Ben, in order to set up a end-to-end subnetwork connection across Ben, we have to go through multiple layers. In this case, we have to go through Ethernet layer, the DWDM layer, and fiber layer, right? There are different switches. They have their own labels, right? Fiber, you can have the fiber label. DWDM, you have the Lambda. And Ethernet, you have the VLAN label. So within Ben, we actually, after receive the request about the VLAN, the Ben would do a pass computation to set up this cross-layer pass just within Ben. And The way we do it right now, we adapt the NDL ontology just within Ben right now, and implement the path computation in Java and to figure out the path. But lately, as Chris introduced, the NDL can be used to describe the inter-domain capability, inter-domain relationship, and the cross-layer adaptation relationship. So that would be our next step. So this is a summary. So right now, what we okay, yeah, that's my last slide. So right now, we what we can do is like this. Okay, so we assume VLAN as universal teaching vehicle between domains for now. So our job is, one, to discover the domain dependencies. Two, to define the stitching sequence tree so that we can, you know, stitch, you know, the backbone provider like NR or I2, or you know, our local network and the VM size. Okay, and our strategy is trying to add the layer adaptation and the configuration details within the site authority. How do you figure out the cross-layer path? You know, that's your local decision, right? And in future work, right now, we're kind of like have a mixed resource description model within Ben Alka. You know, Alka itself has its own property list-based resource description or configuration property description. And within Ben, we extended NDL to all. It's an ontology-based one. So we're going to, you know, replace the whole resource model with NDL-based ontology, so that one, we can describe inter-domain compatibility and dependencies. Two, we can also want to add the QoS part, because right now it's among VLANs they are best effort, right? Secondly, we want to enhance the support to the DTN platform, especially the GMPS. You know, the reality is we always have GMPS island, right? You want to take advantage of that. And the third one is based on the work we have done. We want to add more advanced path validation, computation, and stitching intelligence into the system. And also from the VM subside perspective, right? We already, Alka can already control federate with Eucalyptus. You know, we have developed a set authority interface and the drivers to be able to acquire resource out of the Eucalyptus. And also, right now, the VM technology that Alka uses is a Zen based. So the next step is to make it to use VMware also, to support VMware also. So that's all. Long talk. Any questions?
Tree, it looked like you, so you picked the backbone as the root of the tree. What happens if your slice crosses two backbones?
Then you have two trees. It's a tree, this is because we have only one backbone right now. Right. But actually, the model is, the generic model is a bush, right? You can have multiple roots.
But you need to stitch together the connectivity between the two backbones. So,
yeah, they are.
So who
yeah,
leads?
Yeah.
How do you figure out who's in charge?
Could you work this out offline?
Offline. Okay.
Larry, don't go too far.
Wireless projector feature. This won't take long, and if I don't get questions, I'm going to be very disappointed. So I have some observations about end-to-end stitching. The first one is that concatenating layer 2 networks while staying entirely inside of layer 2 is a very hard problem. Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn recognized it to be a hard problem 30-some years ago. It's still a hard problem. We already have a perfectly good end-to-end stitching mechanism. It's called IP. IP is a pretty good VLAN. It's global. Now, there's this issue of, well, but I want to do a certain kind of experiment, and I can't do these experiments if you don't let me work at layer 2 because I'm doing alternatives to IP, so I have to be at the same layer as IP is. But I would argue that tunneling layer 2 circuits, for example, using something like GRE, over IP, when IP happens to be running over a dedicated layer 2 circuit, gives you, I would claim, 98.4% fidelity. That was a simple math of how many header bytes I give away.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So I could have claimed it's perfectly good from a qualitative point of view, but I could actually put a number on this, and the number is 98.4%. Yeah, sure. Don't be distracted by Ted, right? The final observation is that global port allocation, and I'm using the word port generically here, whether it's a TCP port or a GRE protocol number, works. Global allocation of such numbers on the internet works. It surely is going to work. Could work for Genie. If for the bazillion people on the internet we can make it work, I think we could make it work for Genie. So those are just some observations. We're trying to solve an extremely difficult problem. We have a very low-cost mechanism available to us today. And that mechanism is not going to significantly or qualitatively hurt the quality or the fidelity of the experiments we want to do. Why not use it? So let me give you a sense of what that looks like in pictures, in case you're still confused. So I would argue that from the researcher point of view, they want to go out and acquire a set of computing resources first. Of course, I have my own biases as to how the world works, and it sort of evolves around focusing on where I get to inject my logic, my functionality, my program, and of course those are in the computable parts of the network. So I go out and acquire a bunch of nodes, and they're going to be part of my slice, right? So we have to worry about how we're going to stitch them together, but like I said, IP is a stitching mechanism. I can put my topology in my slice. You can put your topology in your slice. The main takeaway there is the topology that you use is your concern in the sense that your experiment, your slice, your application, your distributed service understands the topology. It may or may not want to take advantage of what's underneath it. That's up to your slice. Part of the argument I'm making here is about whose problem is it, and I'm arguing a very, very large part of the problem is up to the slice, not to the substrate. Now, I will gladly admit that some of the nodes are special. They happen to be interconnected by very good bandwidth, very predictable bandwidth. They are, you know, gigabytes worth of bandwidth connecting a subset of those nodes. So some of them are special, and my slice can be special. Right? If my slice happens to run on the nodes that are specially connected, and I can get some fraction of the specially connected capacity between those nodes, then good for me. And I can do the experiments that I want to do. I can roll out an alternative to IP if that's what I want to do. And, of course, I can have that special set of nodes that are specially connected be just a subset of my larger topology because, after all, I wanted to run end-to-end for some definition of end-to-end all the way out to the edges where the users are, which may or may not have special connectivity. They may be tunneled in purely over IP. And there can I would acknowledge that there can be other special subsets. So I could have an open flow enterprise as part of my slice. And the model that I have here is perfectly accepting to capabilities at layer 2 that I can control and ask for at the layer of the slice. The argument is simply that I don't have to have the substrate give me the end-to-end connectivity. So that didn't take very long. The argument here essentially is that of the experiments I'm aware of that are interested in something in the space of alternatives to IP, What they're interested in is the predictable latency and the guaranteed bandwidth that you get from layer two. They aren't particularly religious about how many layers of tunneling it was going to take to give them that. GRE over IP is a perfectly acceptable format, and I get the nice consequence of living in IP space, which is a very convenient place to live. Good. They're lined up.
The previous slide. So your 98.4% number is predicated on the fact that that is, those are, that my special slice has this, actually a VLAN set up here, right?
No, I don't actually technically.
Well, my special slice has a collection of nodes that have direct Ethernet, direct links.
So direct links between those nodes, which I could address as IP if I chose to. As long as I'm living with that, I could, in fact, address them in some other VLAN way. But
okay, so just to make sure I understand that, I feel like you're hiding the problem. Because in order to get this topology, I, as an experimenter, needed to be able to express, I'd like a collection of nodes set up that have this topology, or I'd like this topology set up between a collection of nodes. And so there still needs to be some stitching done or some way to specify that I want nodes with this topology.
Oh, yeah. So it ends up being
the same problem.
No, I don't think it's the same problem. Within an aggregate, I have to be able to say I want these nodes and I want them configured with this topology. And as an aside, and this is a separate, how the world could be much simpler than we're making it, I would argue that the topology that a research experiment wants to ask for is, in fact, isomorphic to the topology of the physical network underneath it. And I will just make that claim on the side. And if you just, as an example, the RSpec that we use to set up a Vini topology says, here are the sites, and I have a physical connection between A and B and B and C and C and D. Which subset of those would you like? You pick the subset, and then you've specified your topology.
Okay, so...
And the second that I go outside of that special region, I refer to the other nodes that I want to get to in the context of my slice by their IP address.
But if you want to set up one of these dedicated links or guaranteed bandwidth links or whatever cross-aggregate using the scheme,
That's not going to happen. So now I don't have a picture of that here, but if you took this special aggregate that happened to be adjacent to another special aggregate, I will have set those up separately, and the box in the middle, which is going to be able to reach both of those, does the routing, understands the connectivity, and can use IP, does whatever it wants in terms of its topology. It may be the case that there are certain adjacent aggregates that aren't reachable in a perfect way, but that's life, and we're going to have to live with that.
Okay, so I'm just last. Sorry.
So I do think that you've misidentified the hard problem here, right? I mean, so you said, you know, given that we're running on top of dedicated layer two links, right, then the IP stitching is, you know, 98% accurate. And, you know, there are stitching technologies there, like 802.1Q, right, for most of the, for most of the layer two kind of stuff that we expect to have for now, right? And getting and so, you know, establishing a establishing VLAN numbers on an 802.1Q trunk is not hard, right? I mean, there's some coordination, but we're all trying to cooperate here, right? It's not a hard problem, right? It's the getting the layer two connectivity that is dedicated, right? That's the hard thing. And so I don't see that having gone through the harder problem, there's a lot of value in punting the easier problem.
Okay, fair point. I do agree that getting the connectivity is a hard problem, and one could question how much effort should go into that. But that aside, I'm not arguing necessarily that when the opportunities to do VLANs is easy, let's go ahead and do it. On the other hand, I think this problem has a general hardness to it, that I would just caution that we not go down that rat hole. And in principle, this is a very hard problem. I mean, just leave it that way. And I think we're at risk of over-engineering this part of the system for a benefit that I'm not sure is there from a fidelity point of view.
So I'm not really going to ask a question. I'm just going to kind of actually support you. I think that it's important to remember that no matter what connection switching technology you use, it's going to introduce artifacts. Your thing is going to tweak the MTU in a strange way. It's going to might introduce fragmentation you're not expecting. It might do this. It might do that. Adding VLAN tags, doing layer 2 connectivity may introduce latencies that people are not expecting. But I think your sort of fundamental point, which is we should do the simplest thing possible consistent with keeping an experiment, consistent with experimenter needs, is a good one. And I think my intuition is, as with yours, that a large set of experimenters will find this perfectly acceptable. But it's still worth poking at the other stuff.
Sure. It's fine to poke. This is one of how much effort do you put into this, and where is the end of this effort? Because I think this one is a bottomless pit in some respects.
Sure.
And
there's a fine IATF working group that is busily reinventing IP routing because they've made their cross-country VLANs too big, and now they have to route them.
Okay, good. Good example.
So the other observation here is, why stop at layer 2? And I think that this is directly related to this question of the NETC science plan, the scope of Genie, what's in the new requirements document, and all of that. There's some really fascinating work you can do if you have analog optical connectivity, because then it becomes a sort of a software programmable optics and blah, blah, blah. But, ooh, that's not layer 2, that's layer 0. So another way to state your point is there's a broad range of experiments here, and they have different sweet spots.
Yes.
I think that is exactly the sort of the form of the larger discussion that we're looking at over the next few months, and I think it's great. So I also think it's 10 o'clock.
Okay, perfect.
So that's the end of the control framework working group meeting. We now have the Aaron Falk reporting on cool cross-cutting stuff meeting. The transition is subtle, but I'm taking my power adapter. That's really the goal.